BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager, trusted to guide families for over 20 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Well, every time we talk, whether it's remotely on BizNews TV or at conferences, you continue to surprise me and you continue to open eyes. And I think that's the great ambition of any true liberal. And I know Rob doesn't. Did you stick to the script that he was giving you outside?
He's bookending the day, so he can wrap it up and fill the gaps.
But you didn't stick to his script, did you? Okay, Franz, how far along the path are we towards balkanization or who knows what?
I mean, the trend line is obviously balkanization. And it's terribly easy to draw that conclusion now. I mean, everything points there, but Jasper, you must be a bit cautious on banking that completely. Is that it is so easy to make the unitary state work. And in that sense, it's so extraordinary that the ANC doesn't do it. The advantage to itself, I mean, it's getting absolutely hammered. If it loses badly in Gauteng next year, which it will, or early 27, whenever the election is, Helen Zille will probably lead the DA charge in Gauteng and could do very, very well there. And in fact, we must go to that because I think it's the most important political play in the country. And they're going to get wiped out in KZN. They've already lost the Western Cape. What's left beyond that? It's really non-viable provinces, most of which are covered in sort of felt and thorn trees and rocks and dirt, and that's all they'll have left. Then they lose Ramaphosa at the end of 2027. They can't figure out who their leader will be, so they might have a big fight about that, and whoever wins it will so disappoint the voters one way or the other. And the economics that are so strongly against them will remain the case. That, you know, in the short term, they might get a little win from, you know, if something in the MKs, something might happen there, and there might be a little washback into ANC for a time. But ANC voters have already left the ANC, so the hope that if MK goes, they come back to ANC doesn't really hold entirely. So they're facing complete annihilation. And if you watch their leader in parliament this week answering questions, it's such a, I mean, it's an amazing thing to think so casually and slowly. And we'll have a dialogue maybe, and the G20 is sort of enthusiastically behind us. You've crashed Africa's grandest liberation movement into the ground. It's about to catch fire and burn to nothing. And yet these simple reforms are not taken. And the point therefore is this: it was a long way to get there, but that might it happen that it just takes one person to come along and say, "Hey guys, we can be out of this in 24 months," but maybe that won't happen, and this is the end of it.
We had a wonderful parallel drawn for us yesterday by Andre de Ruyter, who told us all about how we were today and said, no, it's not today, it's back to 1989. And also talking to a member of the tribe who I know very well, who's in the audience as well, he explained how he went with John Marie, you remember John, to meet with F.W. de Klerk. And he says that he's not sure that he was the person who changed his mind, but certainly the mind was changed. FW was going one way, he transformed his view, and the country transformed. Now, if you have a look at where we are today, we surely at a similar point as Andre was unpacking yesterday. How would you rate the chances of Ramaphosa being A, humble enough, and B, accessible enough to a different viewpoint to the one that seems to be infiltrating him? 100%.
It's a different moment to 89 in the one respect that everyone that knew anything knew by the 80s how the transition would end. We just took the inflection point of the collapse of the Soviet Union. No one really doubted that the ANC would govern the country, and people had understood the ANC a little bit, had a clear enough sense about how it would do that. So the moment was different in the sense that the old regime was failing, and the new regime would be exactly that. It would be a large nationalist footprint, etc. This time the moment's different in that the old regime is fading, and there is nothing of a similar sort of stature waiting in the wings to come in. So it's different in that one respect. I think it's right that de Klerk understood that the tide had turned and that he needed to act. And I think Ramaphosa's nature, or is certainly the longer-term history, is a very different kind of person and will instead just allow events to overwhelm him and his party. And I think I've made the point on your show before that the idea of Ramaphosa we don't think exists. We don't think he's real. He doesn't exist. The great union leader who brought the mining industry to heel, we think was actually Julian Ogilvie Thompson and others, Michael Spicer, Bobby Godsell, and that Anglo saw in Ramaphosa this catalyst to change the country, but had no need to claim the credit for that themselves. I think they were much more influential than anything else. The second time you see Ramaphosa is this great negotiator who's outfoxed the Nats, but the Nats knew, and they weren't perhaps in the entirety of the highest caliber group of people. And in any event, Mandela was the negotiator with Effia, and the negotiations were directly between them. And the others played a very important role, and not to minimize it. I mean, but that's overdone. And then the third time you meet Ramaphosa, he's this great industrialist, this sort of Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. So, and then the fourth time you meet him, the environment's different. He doesn't have Ogilvie Thompson whispering in his ear, or Mandela, or someone else, and he faces a party that's, I mean, it's run out of most of the things one needs in the government, from money to electricity, and support and confidence. And his nature is to try and find the middle ground between competing objectives in his party, which were ideological and corrupt in the main. So the middle ground between that is well, 40% and headed for 20% in Gauteng. And I don't think it means that he's a terrible person or anything of that at all. He's just not had put it this way. Had Ramaphosa inherited a country that, when he took power, that economy was growing at 4 or 5% and had a 10% unemployment rate and lots of electricity, I think he would have gone down as one of the great African leaders. But what he inherited and his nature in responding to that were the wrong combination for the ANC. And rather than being its savior, he is the person who sees it burnt to the ground.
You made the point, and you keep making the point about fixed investment being 15% of GDP and way, way too low. That's fact. That's not ideology. Those are fact points. What is it that stops? Okay, you mentioned Ramaphosa, and he's not the ideal leader, but what is it that stops the brain's trust, such that it is within the ANC, from appreciating that and realizing it's a pretty simple fix that we can get the money to come into the country, especially now that the Americans are looking for a friend?
No, this is why I don't write off the unitary state option, and I don't think we should. I think it's a fork in the road. It's not, I mean, we're on one of the branches, but it doesn't mean that the other one isn't valid. The answer I now have on that, I think, is quite good, that part of the problem is structural. One-on-one, you can have a conversation with a senior, usually slightly younger, but senior ANC leader, let's say cabinet level, who might come and see you alone. And you can have this conversation and absolutely agrees with every word of, and the not a word of dispute is it's right, and we'll actually tell you we're in much deeper trouble than you even realize. And then he goes back into his party and nothing happens. And I think one of the reasons is structural in the ANC. It's got a structural immunity against reform. It's immunized itself against reform. Its board is its executive committee. And that has once all the hangers-on have been assembled, it's got about 100 members. And drawn from every possible perspective of life that you can imagine, from the ideological to the criminal to just the not very good. And the chairman of the board, because that's what Mr. Ramaphosa is sort of a non-executive chairman. And he sees his role as kind of facilitating a discussion between this 100. And that no decision must be taken until we are in agreement with each other about what to do. And if that means that we didn't agree at this meeting, well, we'll hold it over to the next meeting. We'll start the discussion again. Now, if you ran a corporation along those, you had a weak chairman and a board with different sort of objectives, let alone 100 people on it, and your competitors are taking big bites out of you, you're never going to turn the thing around. And there was yesterday, this is a nice example of this. The DTI put out quite a good sort of thing on South Africa becoming a global leader in hemp production. And that they had an accelerated hemp production master plan for the country. I think it's even called the master plan. And so I looked at it. The master plan will be, firstly, the global hemp industry is set to grow extremely quickly because of for lots of reasons. The master plan includes that in a year, the final master plan will be presented to the cabinet. A year after that, the legislation will be put to Parliament to discuss it. Now, I've no doubt that our global competitors also realize that the forecasts are that the hemp industry will grow by 300 to 500% over the next decade. And I don't think their master plans include, in 3 years' time, putting something to Parliament to debate the consequences of. So I think the ANC immunized itself against reform through its structures, exacerbated by the manner of its leader. And therefore, while it can agree with you and hates what's happening and can see the consequences and are most affected by anyone, the biggest loser, maybe the point John Endres will make, he made it very well in a speech I saw him deliver in Washington about a year or two ago, was that in South Africa, if you look at the losers, and I think this is what John said, the ANC is the biggest one of all of them. And Thabo Mbeki has latched onto that speech and sort of quotes John to anyone who would listen. And so I think it's not a question of not understanding or not knowing or not fearing or not being just horrified at it all, but that there's a structural impasse and they can't get past that. If they fade away and to nothing, that will be a key reason why.
We're going to go to questions in just a moment, but the one point I'd like you to elaborate on, because there would be a lot of people here with a personal interest in it, was when you spoke about the enclaves holding and property prices in some of those enclaves, particularly, say, in KZN and in Gauteng, have really gone way below replacement costs now. If you were looking at it objectively, from the outside, if the enclaves are going to hold, is it an investment opportunity?
Yeah, I think certainly. I think the Western Cape is one of the world's great emerging markets of the next 30 to 40 years, regardless of what happens to the country. So if we are successful and we grow quickly and we're a leading emerging market, the head start the Western Cape already has just draws more energy from that. If on the other extreme, the north of the country falls into greater chaos and anarchy, the dumping of capital and skills on the Western Cape will just become greater and greater. And so the Western Cape's a winner every way around, I think. So I think about as safe a bet that you can make on anywhere in the world now. And you know, if the Western Cape authorities here get a bit bolder, there's some small moves towards that. The Americans would be very pleased to hear from them on a trade deal. And why not? What would Pretoria say if Western Cape agricultural producers were told if your product originates on a farm in Paarl, the tariff rate's 10%? Is Pretoria going to say, no, it must be 30? These opportunities are certainly there, I think. And then the other sort of interest, I was in Port Elizabeth last week. And, you know, the Western Cape frontier is sort of pushing up against PE, and the Western Cape is lots of people in, it's become quite expensive. And you know, if you jog down the beachfront in Port Elizabeth, every time I'm there, I do this and I have the same thought. You know, it's get the right election result in Port Elizabeth, push that Western Cape frontier up against it, starts to spill over. Somewhere like Port Elizabeth might be just, I mean, you can buy I don't know what a 4-bedroom house looking at the sea costs here. But in PE, apparently, I was told last week, it's R1.5 million. So I think there are great opportunities in the enclave future. The thing about, maybe the way to explain it is, don't worry entirely about macro SA growth. Even today, South Africa is not a low-growth economy. There are corners of it that are extremely high-growth economies, filled with some of the best people in the world doing amazing things, world-beating things. And if you want to do well in a future South Africa, don't just think macro unitary state. See through that. And just from a standard of living perspective, you'll recognize that this is an absolutely magnificent place to be for many people.
Lots of questions, as you always know. We kick off with Rob Hersoff's question. If the ANC know they are out in 2029, the mafia or cadres will want to, I know you guys say cadres, in the ANC they say cadres. So forgive my English there. Will want to protect their thievery and avoid being prosecuted. So maybe the only way to keep the ill-gotten gains is to take power. What are the odds of a coup, and where might it come from?
Look, I think if they were serious about keeping power, they wouldn't have tolerated this business of getting to 40%, which is completely unnecessary. They really should never have been there. And winning 55% in the next election for them is the easiest thing in the world. It might be a good thing for the country too. If you believe in the unitary state idea, that's what's important to you. ANC running South Africa, well, makes a lot of sense. And don't be too worried about that, because the only way it gets back is to govern relatively well. So if it cared about self-preservation, it wouldn't have put itself in the position that it's in now, number one. Number two, a sort of coup is very difficult to do. It needs a lot of good logistical planning and hard work and determination. The third thing, when I got my briefing this morning, I was reminded of Constant Viljoen's warning to the white right, who said at the time of the last transition, because we're already at the next one, you know, shouldn't we take the place back? And he said, fine, we can do it. Take it this afternoon. With sort of 20 men, we'll have it. And he said, tomorrow morning, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to govern it? And I suppose that's the thing as well. So I expect it's more, ultimately, it's more with a whimper than a bang for the ANC.
Talal Salim asks, how accurate is the unemployment rate, which doesn't realistically account for informal business?
It does. It's completely accurate. It's quite precise. And the rate is 33% or thereabouts. So that's the first answer. Is there, when you have such an extreme level of unemployment, you will have a lot of survivalist economic activity. People will rent a thing or sell a thing or hustle or trade something to just survive. But we mustn't fall into the trap of calling that employment, because employment, as we would understand it here, is that you either have a business that you go to every day and you earn an income from that and just create another one if that didn't work, or you go to a job every day and come back. And the fact that you find correctly that there are people who manage to put some rands through their account every month must not qualify as that they are employed and that there is something wrong with the country's macro level data. I believe the police advertised for some posts. I don't know if anyone knows how many people applied. It was extraordinary. I wish I remembered exactly what the number. The police recently advertised some jobs, a few thousand, and so many people applied that they were actually a substantial portion of the national unemployment figure that applied. So our stats SA's unemployment data is perfectly accurate, and it is correct that there are people who scrounge some rands every month through their bank accounts.
Trevor McLean Anderson asks, to what extent do the unemployment numbers take into account the informal market? You've just answered that. If crime was a job, how many people are employed in that sector? And what would its contribution to GDP be worth?
Yeah, the informal sector is accounted for in the unemployment data. Crime is interesting. There's a chap with great knowledge of these things who says that if the top 100 violent criminals in Gauteng were arrested and their whereabouts are known, their addresses are known, it would be a simple matter if the police functioned. The effect would be to slash serious and violent crime rates in the province. So the idea is that it's actually a very small number of individuals that are responsible for the great majority of serious and violent crimes that happen in the country. It's not a case of a mass of murderous people sort of stalking the streets, creating mayhem at all. There's a similar point, actually. This is why you mustn't write off the unitary state. Similar point to what I made on how easy it is to get the growth rate back, how easy it is for the ANC to get back to 50. So South Africa's problems and crises would be much worse if we were governed well and still sat in this position. The violent crime position is as absurd as the fixed investment rate. Or the unemployment, the global unemployment rate is 5% this year. Our rate is 33, and then you can escalate it to 50 amongst young people. And wiping out the violent crime problem is really this chap, and I'm completely convinced by his argument, is it's a matter of weeks, and it's over. And society is 70% safer than it is today.
You have been to the command center in Cape Town. I remember you were telling me about it some years ago and how impressed you were. I spoke with JP Smith this week, and his view on this was that, well, he's hanging around there for the last 25 years as a councillor because at some point in time, the DA will get their hands on the police portfolio. And either someone like him or Ian Cameron or someone of that ilk would be able to address this, he believes, very quickly. So it confirms everything that you're saying there. John Endres, your former colleague, where do voters go who abandon the ANC apart from not voting?
In the main, they don't go anywhere. A good answer is this. I chair something called the Social Research Foundation that does some polling on the country, and we looked at youngsters who don't vote, and amongst other things, and tested why. And the conversation essentially, if you put it into very short form, goes like this. Say to young people, will you vote? Never. And you say, why not? And they say, the politicians are terrible and lie to us. And you say, but voting is part of the process to kind of make the country better. Do you dispute that? And they say no. And then you say, well, isn't there a fundamental contradiction happening here? You say you won't vote because the place is terrible, but you say that voting is the way to change that. And then they say a very important thing. They say, you know, if you want us to vote for someone, what you're actually telling us to do is to believe at a certain level that this is invest a little bit of ourselves in this person and say, we actually think they're going to improve our lives. And we're not prepared to do that. And I think it's easy on the political side. I'm not a politician basher. I think amazing people that sit in politics, that is the most terrible job to do. It's heroic. But it's easy, and I understand the frustration from the side of a political party of saying, well, you know, how are we meant to get anywhere with this sort of attitude? But if you got the leaders of the political parties here and you lined up 10 kids who live on shacks on sand dunes somewhere nearby and said, you've got 5 minutes to convince that kid that if you vote for me, you will be out of that shack by the end of my term in office. And Van Onselen, again, when I asked him what's the key formula to be successful in South African politics, Gareth's answer is to create the realistic belief in the mind of the voter that by voting for me, your life will get better. And I don't think there's anyone around at the moment that does that in a compelling way. Yet. And that explains stay away. Don't worry too much about voters, stay away. Young, unemployed kids who feel they've got nothing to lose and have no esteem, if they suddenly dove into politics in great numbers, might dive into corners of politics that aren't in the best long-term interests of the country. So this wildly enthusiastic voter training and recruitment programs are perhaps something just to be cautious of. Let older stay generations dominate the voting markets, probably in the interests of a more stable political result at the moment.
Well, you mentioned leaders of political parties. Cornel Mulder, who's in the audience, said there were 1 million, sound like Zuma, 1,048,000 applicants, for whom 300,000 were graduates for the 5,000 posts at SAPS.
So let no one say our unemployment rate is 5%, because when you advertise for police jobs in the United States, you don't have 12 million people applying for those, of which the half are university graduates. Yeah.
Piet Viljoen asks, or he says, you mentioned correctly that a major difference to 1989 is that there's no coherent group standing in the wings to take control. One, what would your advice be to anyone wanting to put together such a power base? And two, do you think it's even possible to do so?
I mean, the advice is burn the coal, stop taxing capital on arrival and concession the ports, just simply. What you will then do is you'll raise the fixed investment rate. The growth rate will go to 3% within 2 years. And the ANC will win the election in 2029 with 55%. And take the country to a point where its economy grows at 4 or 5% for the next 20 years, and we'll be fine. I think that's the advice. To form a movement to do it, I feel it's almost the wrong way around. Isn't it more often the case that great political leaps are taken by individuals who pull who pull things behind them? I mean, if which was my understanding of it, efforts at the time of the transition were to say to his colleagues, this is what we will do. And Mandela's first economic policy speech after being released from prison was delivered before his party had had its policy conference, because he needed to preempt the conference and dictate the policy, because if the conference had dictated the policy, then the ANC would have been in this position 30 years ago. But Ramaphosa's approach, the complete opposite, is to say, well, let's find consensus and unite and build some movement to move ahead. And I mean, the results speak for themselves. So I think it's a simple matter of key individuals, that don't all have to be politicians, saying these are the three things we're going to do.
We heard yesterday that Evia only had 4 cabinet ministers who supported him. Theo de Jager says, and thanks, Theo, you guys were brilliant, the amigos last night. Those who weren't here for it, you missed something. What is the real potential of the DA, Freedom Front Plus, and IFP to step into the open spaces left by the ANC, and how should they prepare for that? Do they have the leadership to do it?
I think, I don't know about the, I think the IFP, has obviously got enormous opportunity in Natal now. Zuma's voters didn't vote for MK voters. We don't think voted for MK's policies. So I think that's misconstrued, that they're sort of terrible, lot of terribly wild people. We think Zuma's voters voted for the perception of his persecution. So the way that works is Zuma casts himself, because he's such a brilliant chap, he really is the most capable strategist. He says his campaign, as we understood it, was this: I am a great hero of the struggle, which he was, and I am flawed. I've made mistakes, as he put it so delicately. Rather serious ones, but nonetheless. And that really works. And because people like that. It's like Bill Clinton with the interns in the office. And the third thing that Zuma then said is, but now look at what's happened, how the ANC has abandoned me. And that resonated deeply in his base, because they remembered the struggle was great, and they were heroic, and they fought the whites. And they realize, the last decade hasn't been great, but the ANC's abandoned us. Now that's what's behind Zuma's voters, not reading his manifesto, which is complete lunacy. And I don't think he knows what's in it either, because I don't think he's as nuts as the manifesto is. Now, that's the opportunity for the IFP to take advantage of. I don't think the structure of the organization, its professionalism and so on, is able to do that. The other two, the DA and the Freedom Front, I think are in a different position. One of the arguments I've made to DA people before is that you shouldn't try and grow your party, because you are a party now of the established multi-generational middle class. And I think in last year's election, I'm correct in saying that less than half the DA's voters were white. If you're an established middle class person, so certainly going into second generation, you will vote for the DA. And that's the party the DA needs to be. And trying to bring in second and third constituencies of people can create conflict inside a party. And the DA must be as big as that middle class market is. And it must take that. This is an argument I put. They obviously have to do it. I understand I'll get a message from someone later saying, you're not there. We have to do this, which is true. They must take that to a future negotiation. And in this case with the ANC, in the unity government, and do the best they can with that. Or where the ANC governs the country, they must serve as a very effective opposition, which they have always done, and are largely the reason, the principles of opposition instilled by Tony Leon, largely the reason we still have effective, as far as that, but I think they are quite effective, sort of parliamentary politics in the country today. So my advice to is that. Take the middle-class market into a negotiation. Now, in the GNU, and with respect to future ANC, this works quite well, because the only way the ANC keeps a real seat at South Africa's political table is to capture the imagination of the aspirant middle class on the urban fringe, a market the DA struggles to break into. So in a sort of perfect world, this is the formula that a coalition government keeps the unitary state together with. The DA is representing, and the Freedom Front to an extent, the established multi-generational middle class. The ANC is representing the aspirant middle class. The DA has got 20 or 30, and the ANC has got 20 or 30. But the interests of the constituents behind the parties are completely the same, because what secures a future for the established middle classes are the same policies that create a future for the aspirant middle classes. And if the current GNU was run along those principles, which it easily might, in the election last year, 40% of the ANC's votes came from the aspirant middle class and 40% from rural areas and the rest everywhere else. But the rural market is diminishing. And the DA got more than half of its votes from established middle class suburbia. So already you've got that combination at the heart of the GNU. And that would be my answer to the question.
So structural change might within the ANC might lead to a different result. Frans Grenier?
Yeah. Thanks,
thank Alan. You.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful once again benefiting from your wisdom.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, a multi-award-winning, truly independent boutique wealth manager. Invest better with Brenthurst.